Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
So, Sarah, what is the question or topic that you first went into the field to collect data on?
It depends on the project, but I tend to ask questions around how organizations, like the line on my website is like, how organizations like military actors, civil defense organizations, and humanitarian aid providers negotiate crisis disruption and fragmentation. And what that really means is that I'm intrigued by how organizational hierarchies interact with what we would call like ostensibly chaotic or unexpected situations. The project that was the dissertation and is now the book was initially this, like, it's almost embarrassing to me right now, but like it was this like very classic controlled comparison of why was there more interfactional violence between Palestinian militant groups in some refugee camps in Lebanon than in others. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those cases where I am going to say, and I'm going to encourage people, like, look, my question fell apart. It needed to fall apart. It was the best thing that could have happened to it. And this is like the lesson of like, let the question that actually isn't that like locally resonant or significant, like let it fall apart. So I actually wrote about that in Erica Simmons and Nick Smith's edited volume, Rethinking Comparison, where I, you know, started looking at, okay, you have these 12 refugee camps, you have interfactional violence and some, not others. And then I started looking into it and it was like, well, you have these factions and they have the same names, but they're not really organized in the same way. So the question became, why are some of these structured in different ways? You have different hierarchies, you have different practices, you have different sort of ideological commitments or degrees of ideological commitment. And they had really different histories. So when I started asking people like, well, what's going on here? They would just be like, you're asking the wrong question. You need to ask why South Lebanon is different. And the answer that the book provides, the book is called Beyond the Lines, but it's, which is a play on both looking beyond the front lines of conflict, but also looking beyond the lines in like a network sociogram, is the fun story with that. But is that you had to look at how wartime violence had actually shifted the internal structures and hierarchies of militant groups and created entirely new subunits and logics of organization as people tried to cope with these sort of hyper-localized repertoires of violence, which also shifted social organizations. So it much more became a question about why do you get organizational emergence? Why do you get changes in structures and practices? What is the relationship to wartime violence? Which I thought was much more interesting than the initial, like, why more here than here sort of classic political science question.
Well, first question... Sorry, you go ahead, Christian.
Oh, no, I was about to say, she's an explosion. This is going to be good, but what were you going to say?
I was going to say, the first question has the advantage of being something that you could do from a desktop, at least getting started in terms of seeing variation from a distance. Mm-hmm. So how did you navigate the conversations with locals who couldn't recognize in their reality what you saw from a distance? I mean, when you
they could recognize it, they were just like, you're looking at the wrong thing.
Okay.
Or you're looking at the sensationalist thing to a large extent.
So the variation was real.
Oh yeah,
and it was recognizable to them. Mm-hmm. They just thought it was, I mean, what language did they use to push you?
Hold on, no. Don't go there yet.
All right.
That becomes more kind of like insider, how'd you get, what'd you do, how'd you navigate on the ground type of thing. And kind of like the next kind of question is kind of, we'll step back a little bit, which is kind of like, okay, what kind of information, what kind of feedback were you getting about like preparation for going into the field? So we're trying to roll back. Yeah.
All right. So like I did write some notes out for this, mostly because my response when I read this question was like, I hope you write a whole article about how people have responded to this question, because it would be such an interesting exploration of like the narratives that shape political science and what we're told about fieldwork and the assumptions that people have and like, and the things that people, and the assumptions that people don't have. It really varied. And I'm going to go with like the what did academic people tell me. And this was a really interesting, I mean, it was totally different between, this is back when I was still a little, the first time I went to Lebanon was in 2007 after my first year of grad school, when I was still technically an IR security grad student. That's like my deep, dark secret. I came back from Lebanon as a comparativist, which should tell you something. and I think that the narratives are part of this, right? Some people acted, so this is 2007, and it is important to note, like, there was a war in Lebanon in 2006. But some people basically acted like I was going to an active war zone. They were like, are you bringing, like, flak? Like, what are you doing? And, like, there were elections, but it was really like this sort of dramatic thing. And there was a small, very localized war against a militant group that had occupied space in one of the Palestinian refugee camps. It was not Palestinian, importantly, but the Lebanese army, while I was there, basically like leveled that particular camp. So there was like active armed conflict when I was there, but the way that it shaped everyday life was very much not what the expectation of American political science, and I would say like a white male dominated American political science, how that group imagined Lebanon, which was like, you know, civil war. And it wasn't like the mixture of like, oh, okay, you have checkpoints, but you also have a raging club scene. You have elites who are dancing in rooftop bars and paying $12 for martinis. And you also have people hanging out in shisha bars on the street, right? You have people jogging on the corniche. And yes, they're jogging in shorts and t-shirts. Like the number of people right. who are like, oh my God, you have to wear hijab, as if that's something that is like deeply problematic and such a burden on a researcher. And it's like, no, I'd probably dress more conservatively in the US than a lot of people do in Lebanon. So like all of these, you know, it's like these sort of like wartime fantasies, these sort of Orientalist fantasies. And then I also had people who were like, oh, it's Lebanon, like tons of clubs, tons of drinking, like it's just a giant party. And that wasn't entirely true either. And especially as I got into the project, you sort of look at all the different layers and how these different things can all coexist in different ways. It's very different now, to be totally clear. Like Lebanon is now in a financial crisis. And for the first time since I've been going, which again is at this point, what, 16 years? Jeez. But when I talk to like my friends there, my Palestinian and Lebanese friends, like I have friends who are now genuinely worried about kidnapping, right? Like that was a ridiculous statement for people to make in 2007. And just as like an indication of where things are now, like now I'm getting told like, oh yes, you cannot ride the service taxis that you used to go around in all the time. Right.
So just as a small intervention, we often ask a question about that you've already answered, which is what you thought you were going there. But I want you to unpack what you said before about you went in as an IR security scholar and you came out as a comparativist, because I think that transformation is worth it's a thread worth pulling for you.
Sure. The short version of the story is that I went for Arabic language training. The reason that is significant is because the advice I was getting as an IR student, one was that that's not important, which means that I missed deadlines because of various ways in which advising is conducted in IR versus in comparative, and wound up in Lebanon in part because a bunch of people dropped out of the summer language program in Lebanon and I got in. And that has to do with political stuff that was going on there, where the whole place got constructed as insecure. And it, I mean, it was, if you were in Beirut, it was fine. And what happened is that I had the opportunity, I got kind of adopted by a couple of journalists. And because I sort of like previewed this where I said, okay, there was this, you know, very localized armed conflict in northern Lebanon, and where the Lebanese army basically flattened this refugee camp called Nahr al-Bared. And one of my journalist friends was going to interview people in South Lebanon. So I talk about this in the book, actually, because this is an important point of entree. So she's going to interview a bunch of Palestinian leaders in South Lebanon in a refugee camp called Ain Helwe. And if you Google Ain Helwe, what you're going to get is like civil war among Palestinians. It's like this very stigmatized place. And there is a lot going on in Ain Helwe, which is something that, again, I talk about in the book. Anyways, the reason I can talk about it is because I had IRB approval to do the interviews. And I had IRB approval to do the interviews because I initially sent an email to the department and... I sent an email to the department and said, like, hey, I have the chance to do these interviews some of these would have been active militants, and got back like, you know what, just go interview them. Don't really worry about the IRB. And there was more to it, but the bottom line was like, don't worry about this. And I said, I'm going to email one of the comparativists who works on the Middle East. And that comparativist walked me through the IRB process in a week to just be like, okay, here's how we do this. Like, these are public officials and spokespeople. And the common rule has changed since. So things are a little bit different now. But basically walked me through like, okay, look, here's how you put together an IRB. Here's what you need to say. Here's what you can and can't do. I had some Arabic skills at that point, but not like the advanced interviewing skills that I developed over the years, and specifically the dialect, which means a lot. And generally dialect isn't taught in like university level language program. Yeah. But it was really thanks. But I think that like the whole process also taught me, it caused a shift in how I was even viewing, why are you talking to people? What kind of politics are you exploring? You know, you could put it as like, what is this a case of? But I think it was actually deeper than that. I think that it was about, for me at least, and this was coincident with like being around other people who were working in this sphere in the Middle East and basically listening to a lot of like objectification. And it was like, I wasn't comfortable with the way that, people were being told to study these issues, to be totally honest. And what I was given in comparative politics were other sort of analytical tools to look at, okay, why are people in these positions? Why are people, you know, in some cases, this is also, like I described this in various points, like, you know, why when you walk into someone's like office with a journalist, like why would they get on a weight bench and start lifting weights, right? Like that's a pretty funny scene. Like let's unpack that if we're going to be unpacking things, right? So I think that the depth of the why for me matched a lot more the way that I wanted to approach sort of the particular questions and populations that I studied.
Sarah, we don't really do this. This isn't one of our questions, but I'm inspired to kind of go there for a second. First off, why were you an IR student initially? And kind of like what made you think that was kind of something to do? Mm-hmm. Clearly you had some exposure to comparative because you had someone to call. So I'm curious as to, so stepping back from your project and thinking about kind of like, you know, you in graduate school, you saw yourself as an IR person. Why? You gravitated there. That gave you some skills. But clearly there was still something about you that was reaching out and exposed to a little bit of comparative, but you mm-hmm. didn't see yourself as that yet. Mm-hmm. So both, in a sense, IR and comparative were both within you. and then shift happened while you were in the field. But let's go back to that earlier, Sarah. Why was IR your thing initially?
Probably because of what I studied in undergrad. I was like in international studies with a focus in security studies type. I had done DC internships on nuclear security type of stuff. I don't think I really knew what comparative politics was.
I said, oh, you're that kind of person.
I was that kind of person. Yeah, I could tell you all about like the Cargill conflict and nuclear weapons in South Asia. We could do all of that. There's a paper that I have somewhere that is like my a sophomore. It was from a Causes and Consequences of War class where I have like a whole rationalist explanation for Civil War from like 2001. I mean, it is textbook. I came out of undergrad with the like, you are like a hard security, like, you know, sort of. Yeah, there's we could unpack all of like the gender dynamics of that as well, but we don't need to do that in this question. Had sort of like gone through my 2 years in DC and had written my proposal on like, well, why do you, and like, again, I am no longer this person, but I had written my grad school proposal on like, why do terrorist groups negotiate and like go for peace? And like, when do they like decide to join elections? I mean, that's what the proposal was. And then a lot of people were doing that project when I got to grad school. And if like the fifth years and seventh years, I realized that there aren't seventh years in every program, but when like, you know, the advanced students are telling you like, oh yeah, this is what I study. Like, you gotta be like, oh no, I gotta. But I would argue that the other sort of big one of the big transformative things for me was like actually a level of analysis shift. So I took John Padgett's like network theory and analysis course my first semester at Chicago. Everyone told me not to. They were like, what are you thinking? You will be destroyed. And at some point I like stayed up for 2 days straight writing the final paper of that and actually like really got into like the depths of this paper and like interpersonal relationships and interorganizational relationships. So I was basically like, I had gone from this sort of like rat choice, possibly like large N statistical sort of view to like, ooh, relationalism's super interesting. And like, look what happens if you take space and networks and start talking about how all of that interacts with violence. And it really was like John is the kind of intellectual and the kind of professor who will push people. And it really was this like transformative moment. It is what you sort of dream of in grad school is like, oh, wow. And I think that was a big shift. And then when I was sitting in, you know, let's say certain classes in other subfields, I just wasn't nearly as inspired, to be totally honest.
And that's
like a personal thing. That is not me like condemning the field of IR. Like, don't all come after me.
They can defend themselves. But my thing was, what I like is the dualism exists within you in a sense, right? And then you're allowing your interactive experience to kind of like then bring to the surface what was more salient. I mean, we haven't gone there as explicitly in many respects with regards to the earlier ones, but I think it definitely kind of like it reveals that these things that we've set up as being kind of like very hard differences between one another are kind of like reinforcing and morphing in different ways and kind of your co-evolving. But Jesse.
Co-evolution's my deal. But like, look, also it's like there's a love of history that I think permeates many subfields and that you can have in many subfields. But the idea that like I didn't understand. And again, this is me. This is not everyone. Other people approach like research and their degrees and everything differently. But I couldn't imagine producing a dissertation where I didn't talk to people and talk to people firsthand about their lived experience of politics. Like that was just because like that happens to be what I'm good at. But also what I deeply, deeply care about. And that's not to say that it is better than any other technique. It's just that like how I happen to engage. And, you know, that's, I think that also shaped like I want to do comparative. it's much less common to do field work in IR, although people do it and a lot of people do it well. Or I would say some people do it well. but you know, yeah. I wanted to talk to people. I wanted to be like out in the world.
So you've alluded to the fact that you've been going there for well more than a decade. So this is, you know, wave tops. But how did you proceed to collect information, really? So if you wind the clock all the way back to the beginning, you had these journalists that you shadowed. But you know, when your Arabic wasn't very good and your Amaya was non-existent, you know, how did you proceed?
How did I proceed? Sorry, someone just walked in. So I went home after that first group of interviews, took more Arabic, committed to going back in the next summer, and trained the next summer in Amiye, and also volunteered in one of the refugee camps, and didn't do a lot of like interviewing or that sort of work that summer. I did some because I had a grant where I had to do some of it, but it was like, no, I need to stop and get the skill set that would allow me to really like do the work that I want to be doing, if that makes sense.
Quickly related to this, and the world did not collapse. The floor did not fall. Did not fall underneath you when you decided to walk across the aisle and become this other being. It was all fine.
I think, for the most part, it was fine. I think that I did not suffer any real ramifications for it. I think that I wound up with a group of advisors where all of us had a much more productive experience than if I had stuck with sort of my initial affiliation. Things didn't, I just like shifted what classes I was taking. I shifted how I was going to approach my master's paper because we had to do a master's paper. I started looking at classes in a different way. I started looking at, I TA'd for classes that I wouldn't have expected to TA for and like learned a lot. Like I got to TA for organizational decision making, which was probably like one of the most significant choices of my life. It's obviously shaped my work for, you know, my entire career now. So that was really cool. And I think that also, I think it doesn't work for everyone and not everyone has this kind of option, but I was just deeply, deeply embedded in Lebanon from the beginning. Like I spent pretty much every summer either there or taking Arabic. And there were other things I didn't do because I made those choices, right? But I think that to do the project I did, that's what it took.
So what did you end up investigating after that change took place?
So I have this literally takes a whole chapter to explain because, and this is why I actually think that Nick and Erica's book, like Rethinking Comparison, is so significant, because what I realized after the fact is that, comparative politics for a long time has been sort of like trapped in the controlled comparison model. Right. And some of that is because of, you know, the effect that KKV had on the discipline. Some of that is because of straight up Mills methods. It's because of causality, obsessions with causality and particular modes of it. What I wound up looking at is
more and more in the last decade. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, and to be specific, linear causality, a particular form of causality. Like it's not complex causality, it is linear causality and causal identification. And that is not the only way of creating causally motivated arguments, right?
I concur.
What I wound up looking at is how organizations adapt, how they evolve over the course of wars, and how they co-evolve with societies, right? Or with social relations. That's the big picture. one of the lenses that I use to look at organizational evolution is basically how do you get emergent organizations? And this is something that both John Padgett and Woody Powell, who is a sociologist at Stanford, sort of pioneered in the coevolution of states and markets work and all that sort of thing. I look at things that are much more agent-driven and that are much faster in terms of the timelines than sort of John's like, this is how the capitalist system evolved. Like, that was a little big for me. But what was interesting to me is how you could sort of, part of what I did is I actually had an inductive abductive research design where I started off by asking about people's families. A, because that is the polite thing to do in many of the places where I was working, right? And because in many of the spaces where I was working, like, people knew researchers. They had been asked all kinds of dumb questions by like a bunch of people being like, so what's it like to be like a poor refugee? And you're like, you know, the fuck.
Peace.
Right? Like, sorry. I mean, you don't need to like bleep me, I hope. But, you know, or it's like, you know, well, why would you target certain things? Like, there was literally some guy doing terrorism research who was like trying to ask people about targeting. And you're like, what? What are you, really? So what interested me was like, what were people's experiences? How did people make decisions? How did they cope? And what were actually their priorities? Like, and it wasn't like, and this is how I sort of got away from the what I call sort of like the scorecard approach to conflict and combat. Like, people weren't like, yeah, we had to kill everyone. Like, that's which seems to be like, it is this overarching assumption of a lot of conflict studies that we should be obsessed by homicide as opposed to all of the other things that people try to do to negotiate disorder or conflict or war or occupation, right? Like, people put so much effort into making sure that children could still get an education, right? And making sure that children can get an education in siege conditions is not just making sure that you have instructional materials and teachers and timing and that kids can physically walk to school, but it might be engineering to have like a schoolroom that you can actually protect against like bombardment at that time, right? It's for younger kids, it's like, do you have like juice or something to like feed them at school, right? Like, what is it, as if we think about like what kindergarten is, like, is there nap time, right? These incredibly what seem like banal questions that become securitized in these environments, but also become problems for organizations to solve. And I got much, much more interested in how people as members of organizations in roles in organizations went about solving them, right? And that's all really highly skill-based work.
Yeah, I'm like, this is fantastic. Thank you very much. I'm definitely feeling the willingness to kind of go in the non-linear and the non-traditional. So I also appreciate that. But related to that, we're thinking of this is no smooth process, the research trajectory that you've laid out. So just curious about kind of like troubles and opportunities and perturbances and how you kind of responded to some of them. Some that were kind of one-off and some that were kind of recurrent.
So the research design thing, that controlled comparison, I like went off on a tangent, which I tend to do. What's interesting about that is that, look, the assumption of that particular research design is like, there is a unit that is out there to study and it remains that unit throughout time. And what I was working with was organizations that changed where this endpoint, this is not the same organization as this starting point. And I can show you in terms of the relationships, the practices, how people even understand it, that this is different. So this isn't a controlled case comparison because this case is not this case. And it took me a really long time to work through that. And what network analysis does is actually gives you the tools to do that and be like, I actually, it is this dynamic transforming thing. Right? It actually isn't. It's multiple things, and that takes time, and it's occurring in fits and starts. But finding the language for that, particularly when like, and again, like I'm just cribbing from something I've written. It's people are trying to help you get a job as a grad student, right? It's like, no, no, think about that in the book. Like, you just need to like stop complicating your life. Just say the thing, say that there's a control. In 1982, which is really when the analysis starts. And it's like, because it's like, okay, well, was the violence of the Israeli invasion and occupation, was that exogenous to the Palestinian communities that you're studying? And it's like, well, yes and no. Analytically, it probably is, but it's not unrelated to the fact that like there are Palestinians living here and that some of them are organizing politically and are armed and are training people and are collecting weapons. Like, no, it's not exogenous that, but it's also, it was prompted by an attack in London by an organization that wasn't even particularly present in the camps at that point in time, right? So there's the people who are like, just call it an exogenous shock, because then you have your like nice comparison. And it's like, yeah, but not like, and it's like, well, how much were each of the camps destroyed? And is they equal? Like, do they have an equal starting point? And I would find myself in these discussions of like, well, is 80% destroyed the same as 100% destroyed? And it's like, it's all rubble, right? Like, people aren't making that distinction.
It's very powerful what you said, though, which is that it actually, it's coming from a place of of cooperative warmth. On the people who are giving you this advice, it's not like they're trying to destroy the project. They're genuinely trying to help you measure something according to the standards that the discipline expects for high visibility publications.
So it's not sinister. And they probably weren't wrong.
Yes, it's not sinister. It's just, you know, you got a lot of different kinds of people because you have a lot of advantages trying to help you. And what that help actually looks like is pushing you in a direction that you have now rejected. So that's a very interesting kind of
answer. The word is, it was disciplining.
That, I think, is the word we're looking for.
Yeah. And it was well-intended.
But that's one word. But
we could also use punish, I suppose.
But I'm not punishing. That kind of you Chicago grad. it was well-intentioned. But like, and also, like, let's be honest, those pushes were productive. The other thing was like, you need to come back from the field and write your dissertation.
Yes.
That also was not inaccurate. And that was not my entire committee, to be clear, but that was people who were trying to be helpful where I was like, no. I just need to like, I need to do this. I need to do more. There was the, you're studying just one case. So it was just Palestinians in Lebanon. Like, do you need other country comparative cases? And it's like, but that's, the case is not Palestinians in Lebanon. Right. That's not the case. That's not the unit of analysis, but really working through like actually like undoing what the overarching, and it's not like Chicago is a place that is like a deeply mainstream political science department, especially at this time. But the idea of what a proper comparative dissertation and book looked like was overwhelming, right? And like, at this point, I was also like doing fellowships or interacting with other departments. So it was like, no, you like need your hypotheses and you need your dependent variable, and just getting out of the language of variable-based analysis when you're doing, like, even if you know how to do relational and organizational work and you have all of that sociological training as well as the political science training, getting out of like using the variables because that is what is legible as a form of knowledge production in the discipline, like that is incredibly hard and it works against you. But then, so it was all of these little tweaks, and that was super hard. And it took a lot of intellectual energy, if that makes sense.
So I want to ask a follow-up to that, and I apologize for interrupting, but this is all very valuable. You've given a kind of a very rich litany of bad advice or advice that you had to modify on your own. But now that you're at the end of your book, it's published, you can, you know, buy it on Cornell right now, and you can see it as a finished product. Mm-hmm. What advice did you remember getting in this period that in retrospect was right on the money?
And go more radical.
Go be specific and unpack what you just said.
Yeah. So and this would be John Padgett, 2013. Go more radical. So the idea was I had submitted one of the chapters to APSR. This is what is now the APSR 2013,
yeah.
Right? And I got an R&R in the middle of trying to finish my dissertation, which was not finished when I was in a postdoc. Don't be me, kids. Like, really, that was not great. And I was getting pushback from reviewers who were trying to, like, you know, push me into the, like, what are the variables? What's the dependent variable? And John's advice was go more radical, which is like, you are never, 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 never going to please anyone who wants a particular kind of causal inference. You are never going to be able to, like this is not a project that fits into these frameworks. So don't try to fit it. Don't try to like slide it in. Don't try to like quietly slip through the crack in the door, like kick the door down. You know, I think that is that simple line was like the best advice, because I think that's what got the piece published, that I was just like, no, I'm going for it. And if they reject it, like, fine, because I put it out there.
And then you know, got that hand on the rock climbing wall, and then you're in the wilderness for a while longer.
I had that grip.
But you have the confidence in yourself. And then eventually the World Politics article hits and other things happen, even though you go through a lot of rejections.
I can tell you funny stories about like how there's usually a reviewer who's like, this just isn't political science. Here's the thing. I don't care. I would say that the other, like just from people like Elizabeth Jean Wood and Lisa Wedeen, is like, you do all of this ethically. And the fact that like the ethics cannot be divorced from the methods and the data, like the data is sound because the ethics are sound. Yeah. Right. And I think that that's essential, that I was always, that I had committee members and friends, like also colleagues within the department at Chicago, at Yale, where I did a pre-doc, at GW, where I did my postdoc, like where it was constant accountability for like, you speak in the language, are you being loyal to the history? Like anything from like, how is the periodization of the conflict to like, have you been to this archive? To, is this how you want to approach transliteration, which for anyone who is working in Arabic is just like, and my transliteration system has actually changed between articles and the book because I wanted a certain kind of accessibility in the book that I don't necessarily worry about as much in academic articles, but moving out of what's called the IJMIS system of transliteration because it wasn't legible to many of the people who I work with and talk to in Lebanon. But so I think that like that accountability, the absolute like endless support that I got from people who in political science may be classed as like, you know, regionalists or Middle East specialists or area studies, like I think that knowing that again the deep accountability for the empirics made the project so much better. Like the number of just like historical inaccuracies that are allowed to slide in political science is frankly ridiculous, like ridiculous and offensive. Like history is not a toy that you get to play with, at least like where I'm coming from. And sort of like the way in which people play fast and loose with history and act as though it's not like a deep, deep commitment to mobilize history to make political arguments. Like there is a politics to that. And I don't think that the discipline respects that sufficiently. I think that I had the kind of mentors who were like, you are accountable to this. You should hold yourself accountable to this, et cetera. So like, I think that I've benefited from like extraordinary mentorship and like extraordinarily good advice that often went against the grain. And that some of the best advice was like to talk to the people who were going against the grain. Right.
That's really good. Yeah. It's interesting to hear your, speaking kind of, extemporaneously about some of your stuff. I hadn't realized, that you were my people, but definitely, I feel that there as well. I think my How Social Movements Die book was trying to document the people at the end that were formerly in the same thing were not the same people in the beginning and how we got to that point. So that documentation. But I want to follow up on one of your threads, which was kind of like, don't be me, kids. and really to kind of extract from your experience this your understanding of the research process in general, I think is so fascinating and quite lived and you believe it. I mean, mm-hmm. so there's something that I think that that's unifying a kind of an abstract formalization and a lived experience. And now you're kind of in the middle. And I think that's what you've articulated in parts has been really kind of revealing about how one should approach the research process. But I'm curious if you were asked kind of specifically how your experience influenced your understanding of the research process and where you are now on this end of it, what would you say?
Oh, how all of this influenced my understanding of the research process. I think that I have been able to, because of sort of where I happen to sit in the discipline, and frankly, like some of the debates that I've been present in that like that happened to come up at certain points in my career that have profoundly shaped my career, right? That there are a lot of different ways of pursuing the research process. Like, yeah, I could give you like, okay, here are the tenets of the scientific process and all of that. But thinking about, I think that I've had the opportunity, particularly because of the conversations that I've been involved in around DART and the qualitative transparency deliberations and various conversations in QMMR, and then also as part of advancing research on conflict, thinking about the different ways that we approach research, the different methodologies, right? The different epistemological and methodological commitments that we have, and how we are, and how those are all about power. And we're also, as researchers, situated in webs of power. Like, I think a lot about how power operates in research, and not just in terms of like, you know, if you're working in like fragile and violence affected environments, like, yeah, obviously power is coming to play. That's ethics 101, right? But thinking more, or having the opportunity to think more about knowledge creation and how it's done, particularly in the discipline of political science, how it is gendered, how it is raced, how it has, you know, excluded many voices, right? And that's an epistemological flaw in many cases, right? As well as methodological and just like a failure of ethics and morality, right?
Hard security.
sorry. See, this is the like I'm on camera, and now you just get the full body eye roll, right? And that's not to say that like hard security shouldn't be studied. It's like let's get into like what the metaphor of hard security is. Like, but thinking about the research process and how different people approach it, I think I've actually gotten more of an appreciation, to be totally honest, that not everyone does or should approach research the way that I do. Like this was, I think in many ways for me, like it is a full life and full lifestyle commitment, given the populations that I study and the power dynamics in which people are situated. I don't think that is right for everyone. I don't think it's how everyone has to do research, right? I think you can do robust, systematic, quality research that informs the intellectual, social, political, economic world without having it be your life. I happen to really love immersive research and the, you know, if we're talking about like hierarchies in everyday life and power and lived experience and like socialization in particular, like I am particularly attracted to immersive methodologies, but also to thinking now. I think that this is one of the revisions that I've made after that first project is how can my positionality allow me to do research that leverages my particular position to examine power, right? That is gendered, that is race, that has to do with which passport I carry. It also has to do with like what I am willing to do to be competent in the field. So I wanted to study first responders. I went and got certified as an EMT. That's also because I have, given the places where I've worked, I actually really wanted to have practical skills and not feel like a useless human being in the spaces where I was working. Like I wanted to actually really, really think about what it meant to be in these spaces and what was owed in many cases, or to think about reciprocity a lot more seriously, or to think about exchange, or to think about presence in particular ways, right? So that's, I mean, so thinking about how I've altered my own research practice, how I've in some ways deepened it, how in some ways I've been like, I like thinking really seriously about how does one study up, particularly when those who are, when you're studying up, when people have so many more opportunities to push researchers out or to manipulate them in particular ways. Like,
what's something that you can study up as an EMT? More better than you could study up before you had the training?
It allows me to study states genuinely and openly. Like, it's a study of state power. Like, look, when we get to emergency services, those are, I think, one of the, they're a profound measure of state capacity, right? And of how states think about power. Like, you know, public safety in the U.S. is fire, EMS, and it's police, right? That is public safety. And we could get into the politics of calling that public safety, right? In other places, including in some places in the Middle East, the police are separate from emergency medical services. Right. In some cases, it's fire and police. In some cases, it's not. Mm. Right. But being able to talk to people on their own terms, understanding why that organization matters, like, and actually, like, deeply, deeply loving the work that I do in terms of that, like, there's nothing there. That is an identity that I have chosen to inhabit and that I would continue to inhabit if I were not doing that research. To be totally clear, like in some ways I was like, I built a project around a thing that I really wanted to do personally. And that's not, I don't think that's a problem. To be clear, I do not study the fire department of which I am a member. That is a hard red line for me, that is what I do. And that is my volunteer work. But does it inform how I look at the world? Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's very different given the work that I did previously to think about studying the state and studying state actors from a position of empathy, right? That's something that is challenging.
Juxtaposing this, Sarah, to the one that was looking at nukes and so forth is that's a very far path you've taken.
Well, I mean, but I think it's also about... what does political science miss? Political science, particularly when it comes to like violence studies and conflict studies, loves the sensational, loves the visible. And I sort of fell in love with the backstage labor of power, right? Like so much of Beyond the Lines is thinking about that backstage, the people who aren't studied because they are not asking to be studied. They are not talking to journalists. It would actually be extremely poor form given what they're doing to be talking to journalists. And something that I think is really noteworthy about a lot of first responders is that they do not take bows, right? Like politicians put them up and give them medals. And many of them are just, they're deeply, so many of the people who I know in these fields are just deeply, deeply humble, right? But so much of their labor is what society just sort of expects to be there. Mm. Right. And that's really interesting compared to other you know, street level bureaucrats or state actors or whatever political science wants to call them. Right. But yeah, political science likes the nukes. As one of my former graduate students, Jen Spindel has pointed out, like political science, likes the nukes and the super shiny planes and doesn't care about warthogs, and warthogs win wars. Right? Like these really sort of like the gritty weaponry, like you can see the bias in what people study. And she makes the point that actually that like shininess does drive political outcomes when we're talking about the weapons market. And I think that, you know, you can sort of work through different realms of political science and find where that happens.
Hello. Thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive. Writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future, please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.